bringing you a slice of Africa today. This is the Joe Downtown Show from KUNV 91.5 FM, recording at the Beat Coffee House in downtown Las Vegas. Now, most of us have never been to Africa, and though I think a lot of us are sophisticated enough to know people there are just like you or me, we've also seen images over many years of television and broadcasts of children with rocket launchers, tribesmen with machetes, endless civil war, starvation. And the latest was that horrific killing in Nairobi of some 60 people by terrorists or whatever the group was in a city mall. And guess what? Somebody from Las Vegas just got back from there. Josh Ellis just returned from Nairobi after a month, a trip that was remarkably paid for largely by local residents. But more on that later. Now, if you don't know Ellis, he's the millennial's anti-millennial, the anti-hipster. He's also an ardent critic of the way things are redeveloping downtown, with pointed criticism of the so-called community building by new entrepreneurs, whom he believes use, quote, community as a public relations tool, when the reality, he believes, is none of these new business people are really any different than the old business people. In other words, bottom line oriented. Now, why does anybody care what Ellis says? Well, he used to have a column in City Life, but doesn't anymore. He does have a blog, but largely it's because he's been around Las Vegas for a long time. He's articulate and vocal, and frankly, he's entertaining enough in the way that he expresses his views that he grabs the attentions of those who support him and those who don't. He's unabashed, unafraid, I'd say something of a bull in a china shop. However, he's malleable enough to change his mind. I've seen it. And he's well known enough that he managed to raise $12,000 through an online crowdfunding application, which paid for his trip to Africa. His reason for the trip was to examine how a third world country uses today's technology, to see how they are using the inventiveness of the smartphone and the internet to address community and societal needs. And to some degree, I'm sure he went there to shame the app masters here who are developing programs and websites that might or might not be simply contrived to fit the needs of the bourgeoisie. So Josh is back. Let's call this a cleaning of the pipes then. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So you fly into Nairobi a month or so after those killings occurred and after the leader of the killers said they would target any foreigners. You must have had a little trepidation, a little fear.
Yeah, I was pretty terrified, both by those reports and by a lot of the things I would see online when I looked at travel advisories for Nairobi. And it honestly took me about a week to realize that it was nonsense. Al-Shabaab, the group that was responsible for the attack on the Westgate Mall, I never saw any evidence of any threat to me. Though while I was there, there's a neighborhood in Nairobi called Eastleigh, which the locals call Little Mogadishu. It's where a lot of the Somali refugees have ended up, including probably the Al-Shabaab people. While I was there, somebody threw a grenade into a matatu, which is a sort of minibus that's used for transport there. I myself didn't see any real violence. The closest I came was having to scare off some carjackers.
So that was in another part of the city, similar to what we would read about here, somebody getting killed someplace. And
yeah.
It wasn't in your vicinity, immediate vicinity.
Nowhere near where I actually was, no. I think that the Westgate story, from what I heard from the locals, was far more complicated than it was made out to be in the media. And there were a lot of things that never made the news here. A lot of the, at least according to the locals that I spoke to, a lot of the looting that was done in the mall that was blamed on the terrorists was in fact done by the army once they had taken it over. And some army personnel were in fact arrested for that. But we do have this perception of sub-Saharan Africa as a sort of dystopian wasteland, kind of like an open air game of Call of Duty where it's just constant murder and mayhem and everybody's killing each other with machetes. And I found that was not actually the case.
For those who don't know, Call of Duty is a video game. It's a militarized video game, which is actually quite fun, but keep going.
Yeah, Sub-Saharan Africa is not a live action first person shooter video game. I suspect that Nairobi, I've never been to Mexico City, but I suspect that's probably a pretty good analogy for what it's like. It's a combination of the 21st century and in some ways, the 18th century.
So you landed there. You're obviously, probably think you're American unless you're wearing like a Canadian T-shirt or something.
No, they actually assumed I was British because Kenya, it was a former British colony. So their first assumption was most people's was that I was British. I thought it was interesting, actually, a lot of people there seemed incapable of recognizing different accents. They couldn't tell if somebody was American or British simply by their accent.
Oh, I was going to ask, did you pull out your fake accent and use it? But I guess not.
No, and in fact, considering British colonial history there, I felt far better being an American than I did a European. Whenever Europeans trot out American imperialism, just show them pictures of sub-Saharan Africa, the things that the British did in Kenya, the things that the French and the Belgians did were atrocious and borderline unforgivable.
So now let's go to your travel then. I know you're well versed in the history because you probably did a lot. Was somebody there at the airport waiting for you? Did you know where to go? What did you?
No, I had made some tentative plans to interview people and some contacts, but I essentially arrived there completely alone, and all I had was a hotel reservation, and I had to sort it out from there. Which I did. I ended up making friends there and making contacts pretty quickly. I spent 3 weeks total in Nairobi itself and then a week in Kampala, Uganda, the capital of Uganda, which is the neighboring country. I took a 20-hour bus ride from Nairobi to Kampala, which was a very eye-opening experience and an object lesson in things you take for granted about infrastructure or the lack thereof.
Did you fly out of Kampala then, or did you have to go back to?
Well, yeah, my original goal was to catch a bus to Kampala, spend a week there, then spend a few days in Kigali, Rwanda, which is the neighboring country to Uganda. But when I first arrived in Nairobi, after a couple of days, I developed dysentery, and I was getting over it. But the idea of another 24 hours on a bus was just, I couldn't take it.
Were you like in cold sweats and having fantasies about apps and a miracle computerized?
I found myself actually the cold sweats and the shakes. I got the explosive output that you get from dysentery. And I was in my hotel room completely jet lagged. So I was waking up at 1 a.m. and lying in my bed. And I had the song "Used to Be a Cop" by the Drive-By Truckers stuck in my head. And I was just sitting there shaking in my bed. Just with this like alt country music going through my head in the dark, it was surreal and not very pleasant.
Well, you do look much thinner since you got back. So you weren't attacked or anything?
No, the closest I came to being attacked was when I was in the Kisumu bus station. Kisumu is a town near the Ugandan border on Lake Victoria. It was the middle of the night. I got off the bus and a guy immediately tried to sell me something. He said, "Do you want to buy some toot?" And I was like, is this 1970s LA? Are you offering me cocaine? Is that what that... I have no idea. I declined, and I went off to have a cigarette away from the bus, and I watched this guy and his friend. They were kind of giving me the eye, and it's the middle of the night. I'm the only white person around. And so I just pulled my knife out and started cleaning my fingernails with it, and they vanished. And then near the end of my trip, I was in a marketplace called Gikomba, which is where there's a lot of industrial artisans who make sort of things that here would be made in factories. And I was buying a trunk, and my taxi driver told me to let him buy the trunk because if I went, they would try to charge me what you could kind of call the white guy tax. And so I sat in the taxi. He told me to roll the windows up and lock the doors. Gikomba's rough. I had walked through there before, and it was definitely scary. And when I was sitting there, a couple guys were kind of eyeing the car and eyeing me and kind of trying the door of the car to see if they could get in to steal my bag or rob me or something. So I just pulled my knife out and waved it at him, and they
was left. This a big knife, or is this like a Swiss Army knife? Or
no, it's a Gerber chameleon pocket knife. It's kind of thing that's legal in America to carry. And
a Gerber chameleon. Remember that, people, when you go to Africa.
Yeah, so I recommend that knife above all other pocket knives. It's got a very interesting mechanism.
Does it have a bleed gutter? And
no, it's. Although those are always useful, of course. The way it opens is the pivot point is a ring, so you put your finger through it, and you can't lose it. It can't slip out of your hand. Nobody can take it from you. And the angle for cutting is much more natural. You heard it here, folks. Uncle Josh recommends the Gerber Chameleon.
So what did you find? You didn't find Uncle Josh. People in grass huts. Was it a modern-day Vegas in the middle of searing heat? What was it?
No, that's... So what's funny is actually there are grass huts everywhere, and they look like something out of 1940s Hollywood. Like if you saw them in a movie in the background, you would assume that the producers were incredible racists. But yeah, little round huts in the countryside, not in Nairobi. You know, it's funny, people were telling me things like, you know, watch out for hippos. And Nairobi is a city of 3 million people. You're about as likely to be attacked by a hippo in Nairobi as you are to get mauled by a bear in Pike Place Market in Seattle. It's just not going to happen. But, you know, traveling through the countryside on the bus and then going to Uganda, which is definitely a step down on the economic ladder from Kenya. Yeah, it was very interesting to see the different ways that people live there. Some things are extremely modern. Something like 85% of the population has mobile phones. Their 3G broadband is incredibly widespread. I didn't lose connectivity anywhere out in riding a bus. And in Nairobi, it was faster than my 3G is here with a T-Mobile network.
So you got to excuse my stereotype. So people are starving in the streets, but they all have cell phones?
Nobody's starving in the streets. And that's one of the things that I found unrelated specifically to tech, but it's also part of what I want to cover in the book.
By the way, I should mention, I don't think I did mention this. Josh's reason for going there is to write a book. Sort of comparing, contrasting, I think, is going to be part of it. What he sees in the tech industry here, he's sort of a tech guru himself, versus how they use tech there. Go on.
Yeah. And so the book is nominally about technology and innovation. But one of the things I found fascinating was I went to a place in Nairobi called Kibera. It is a very well-known slum. It's the largest slum in Africa. There's an estimated they estimate there's like a million people living in 1 or 2 square miles. And I was aware of Kibera from media. They filmed part of the movie The Constant Gardener there, for example. And it has been painted widely in the media as sort of a place of infinite sadness and horror, where there are starving children crying in the streets and people dying and corpses or, you know, whatever sort of things.
Bring out your dead.
Yeah. And when I had told people I was going there, people were telling me I should get bodyguards. And instead, I got a guy I met who was a programmer and who was from Kibera, and he and his friend agreed to just walk around with me. And Kibera is not a place of infinite sadness. I saw no starving children. I saw no dying people. It's an achingly poor place. It's incredibly poor. There's one toilet per probably 1,000 people. They don't have the houses that people live in there. They're sort of rusted tin roof shanties. And if you saw a picture of one with no context, you might assume it was a place you kept pigs or animals in America. Mud floors, no electricity, no running water. And yet, walking through Kibera, what I saw were people living absolutely normal lives. People working, people having fun, children playing. I went in an art gallery there, and it looked like an art gallery you would find here. There were flyers on the walls for New York gallery shows. The guy who owned it had spliced power out of a light pole and had a Mac Pro sitting on a table in the corner. But the gallery had no floor. It was just mud. The artwork was as sophisticated as anything you would see in something like the, Jesus de la Luz Gallery in Los Angeles. And my friend who lives there told me that NGOs and humanitarian groups, because they make so much money off of relief efforts, tend to portray places like Kibera in this sort of very horrible way. And he said he'd actually seen photoshopped pictures that made things look worse. He joked that NGOs would come in and find a little kid and ask him if they'd had lunch yet. And if the kid said no, they'd film the kid and get him to say that he was hungry.
What?
Yeah, no, I mean, nobody's starving in Kibera. They eat very well. The food's very cheap there. That is not in any way to deny that there are horrible, horrible problems there, and or to minimize the seriousness of the situations there. But the thing is, people survive, and they have community there. One of the fascinating things about Kibera is the government has been trying to tear it down for decades. Recently, they've been building these big apartment buildings and giving people who live in Kibera free apartments. And what the people do is they take the apartment and they rent it out to somebody else, and they, for 5 times what they pay for their place in Kibera, and they still live in Kibera. They become absentee landlords.
Did you notice, and I don't want to go too much into this because we've got a lot of other stuff to talk about, but I'm thinking about Las Vegas and the poorer sections here. Was there a lot of drug use did they talk about that?
I didn't see a lot of it. I saw there's definitely booze. I mean, they have their own local beer called Tusker. I didn't even see people really smoking pot. I didn't get the impression that was a big thing, because drugs take money. And the baseline for being poor in East Africa is several orders of magnitude lower than the baseline being poor here. If you went to your average sort of ghetto apartment in Las Vegas and took photographs and took it to them, they would say that that was a lower middle class person, mm-hmm. maybe even middle class, depending. Poor people in America have far more material possessions and a far more comfortable life. I'm generalizing, of course, and there are probably parts of America and places where it's bad, but I've been all over this country. I've lived in many different places and experienced many different ways of living, and I've never seen in America the kind of poverty that is pretty much standard there. But poverty is, it's complex. It's not as simple as saying they don't have money, because their society works differently. Measuring their quality of life by how much money they have per day, for example, you know, oh, they only have $1.50 per day, would be like measuring your happiness by how many kilowatt hours of electricity you use. It's just the wrong metric.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Now, while you were gone, and this does pertain a little bit to what you went there for and what you see here, there are a couple controversies down in the downtown area, which I write specifically about. One is, well, maybe you were still here when this happened. The mural on this building was painted over. The mural was one that was painted for the Life is Beautiful Festival, which was supposed to be a community festival, and to a large degree it was. But it depicted the mural, a cowboy with a slot machine as a chest, reaching out to hands, reaching up and out from the sand. I'm not sure what it meant, but I thought it was kind of cool. It sort of allowed you to make up your own mind and interpret it your own way. Nonetheless, it's gone, and I wanted to... Is there anything you can take from that and compare it and use it into what you saw in Africa? That's a tough question, but...
One of the things I saw there that I will regret for the rest of my life not purchasing when I was in that art gallery in Quibera was a painting. And it was a painting of Quibera, of the shanties, of the slum, with a gigantic waterfall running through the middle of it, washing away the dirt and people cleaning themselves and bathing in the waterfall. It was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. You know, there's that great quote from René Ricard, who was a New York art critic, when he was talking about Jean-Michel Basquiat, where he says that, I'm paraphrasing, but that for poor people, art is a way to pull yourself up out of your circumstance. And that's a much different notion from the fancier idea that art is some kind of scam or hustle. And Ricard says, but you can never explain to somebody who used God's gift to enslave what it means to use God's gift to be free. I feel like art is an expression of thought, of culture, right? Public art should be a representation of a community's cultural values. In that sense, the whitewashing of the mural was absolutely accurate because it is a perfect example of how this community views itself, which is that anything that is negative, anything that is critical or controversial should be wiped away. The only things that should be allowed are things that are vaguely edgy, you know, to make people feel like, oh, that's edgy. Like the painting on the building over here of the kind of the zombie guy talking about his girlfriend left him. And it's cute. It's a perfectly nice mural. I like it. It's about as controversial as a Lawrence Welk episode. This Las Vegas traditionally has tried to avoid anything that represents or reflects to the public the realities of life here.
You're saying what's happening down here is akin to what happened on the Strip?
Of course.
In a smaller scale?
Of course. And especially because community here is defined by one metric only, which is economic development, how much money is flowing in. Money is the absolute only metric for success in Las Vegas. And I'll challenge anybody who tries to tell me otherwise. And so when you show things that depict, you know, for example, the gambling addiction, which is a very, very real and serious issue here, nobody wants to see that. They want to see things that make people feel cool for coming to downtown, but not confronting the complicated and difficult realities here, the ambiguity of it. So I completely understand why it happened. It's not a public building, you know. The people who own it, they can put whatever they want there. If they wanted to put scary murals up, they could do it. If they wanted to put a picture of the Teletubbies dancing around the corpse of Oscar Goodman, they could do that too. But they won't, because those are things that don't interest them. They don't further their interests.
I guess that wasn't such a strange question. Well, secondly, something happened down here at the downtown container park. This was while you were gone. They had been checking bags of anybody who came in. It caused a real uproar among some residents around the area. They just didn't like it. I mean, what other mall did you have to go to and get checked, have your bags checked? So they rescinded it later as they were celebrating it, really on a website on Facebook. A downtown business person wrote a comment which upset a lot of people that said something like, "You people in the cheap seats, quote, cheap seats, don't understand what's going on." Anyways, did that controversy, it went away really quickly, do anything to alter or strengthen your views?
No, I was aware of it because during a lot of my downtime when I was in Nairobi, I had nothing to do but, you know, check Facebook. I've never been checked, had my bag checked to go into Town Square or the district or whatever, Green Valley. I think that it's a reflection of the fact that you decided to put it in a economically disadvantaged neighborhood. I also have never seen security guards out front of Town Square, but then again, they didn't build Town Square where there's a lot of homeless people and addicts. There's been a lot of controversy about the fact that you've got bars next to playgrounds. And that doesn't strike me as something that was unavoidable. Somebody designed that to have the bars next to the playgrounds, and then they complain about the fact that nobody wants to have bars next to playgrounds. Well, you could have moved them. I'm not especially sympathetic to the business owners in this neighborhood when they complain that people don't like what they've done. Their job is to build something that works for people. And if it doesn't work for people, then that's their fault. I went to the Container Park for the first time yesterday, and it is a very lovely mini mall. It's a really well done mini mall, and that's exactly what it is. It's a mini mall. What bothers me is the level of hype over it, like they've created some kind of Le Corbusier idealized pleasure pavilion in the middle of the city instead of another mini mall, which last time I checked was something that Las Vegas was not short on the ground with. We've got mini malls down pat. We are very good at mini malls. We just built a slightly hipper looking mini mall.
Well, in their defense, you want to create something to bring businesses to the area, and you want to create them in a concentrated area. I mean, you're going to come up with something, and you can call it a mini mall if you want, but there's nothing else designed like this. It is nice to go in, as I would say, nice lines. I mean, it's pleasurable to walk around. So
no,
what's wrong with that?
It evokes two French words for me, petite and bourgeoisie. It's a place for people to go and bring their children and feel very hip that they're having barbecue in a place that looks like the Port of Long Beach. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't have any particular hatred for it.
Remember, you couldn't have done that 6 months ago or a year ago,
right,
or 2 years ago.
But the question that needs to be asked is, why was that something that was so incredibly desirable that we all... I was not longing for the ability to have fish tacos on Fremont Street in a modified shipping container. That was not a dream that I had been pining away for.
Your dream of dreams, what would you rather see?
What I would rather see, first of all, is for the people who are actively building this to stop using economic development as their metric. That doesn't interest me. I don't care. That's not what community is to me. It never has been, never will be.
Remember, this isn't a government agency. These are private individuals, hundreds of millions
right.
of dollars.
No, they want to be real estate speculators and build a bunch of crap. That's absolutely their privilege. And if people want to support that and go and buy douchey crap from them, then that's awesome. The use of the word community is what makes me reach for my revolver.
They've taken the word community out of the downtown project's slogan.
Right.
It's connectedness now.
Right, connectedness, and that's cute. The problem is, to me, what community is about trying to improve the lives of the people who live in a place. The Container Park is, to me, a non sequitur. It's cute, yeah, but this neighborhood would have benefited, I think, far more from, for example, housing, more low-income housing rather than less, and more low-income housing for people who are not Zappos employees or startup developers.
That may have been I don't want to get into this, but we've got a little time left, and we've avoided the main point. Compare and contrast.
Oh, they've won. They've driven the poor folks and the shifty Negroes out of here. They're gone. And the poor white trash and the migrant workers, they're all gone. What you've got is a lot of beautiful people coming down here to find meaningful shopping experiences.
I'm not saying you're not beautiful, but where will you go from here? If you don't come downtown, Where are you going to go?
You know what? I'm going to come downtown. They've won. I'm more than fine with it. I don't particularly...
I don't see you in your skinny jeans yet, then.
I am wearing skinny jeans.
You are?
I bought them in the toy market in Nairobi to go to an Intel party.
Skinny jeans, where's your goatee?
On my face. What are you talking about? Joe's looking right at me here. I'm wearing skinny jeans, and I actually have a goatee and a hoodie.
However, you do app. You're an app guy. You know, I'm not one of these people. I just say app guy. So we got to get to the point. I think we got about 2 minutes left.
Well, but first, let me correct that. I'm not an app guy. I'm a technologist and a futurist. Building apps doesn't interest me. Building useful things does.
If that's what I want to get at. Now, what did you learn in that regard? What you saw there versus what you're seeing here, and you, time's limited.
One of the things I thought was very interesting was that a great number of the startups that I saw there were things that served a social value rather than a purely capitalist or commercial one. They were designed to make the lives...
Name one.
ImFarm, which was one of the startups that I had become aware of before I went there. They have created a marketplace that allows farmers to buy and sell their products to either people, like individuals, or to distributors. At fair market value, using their mobile phones, using the M-Pesa payment system, which dominates Kenya. It's designed to make the process of buying and selling fair for people who are essentially subsistence farmers, certainly not corporatized anyway. These are people who literally live out in the country and just have a farm that their family has had.
So I'm out in the country, 30 miles from anything. I can. Who comes and picks it up? Who does the transport? All that stuff.
I would have to look at their specific deal, but I know that it's basically handled by their agents. ImFarm has agents out there. Hmm.
Give me another example.
And I'm blanking on the name. You'll have to forgive me. I want to say it's Ochumi, but that might be wrong.
Don't worry about it. What does it do?
It's a way of doing educational stuff for kids via SMS. Because even though many people there have phones.
SMS?
Yeah. But SMS is the dominant technology there because most people who have phones don't have smartphones.
So how can you get enough information on that tiny screen?
You improvise, which is what they seem to be better at than anybody here. You figure it out. You learn to deal with the inconveniences because...
Did they talk to you, the guys doing this, about that? Do they know what's going on here? Are they envious?
They're not envious. I think they're envious of the amount of investment money that we get. Certainly, they're not primitive. I met most of the coders I met there were could get a job here perfectly well.
And these aren't college grads. These are just
kids. No. These are college grads. That's the thing. I mean, 65% of
what is a college in a grass hut? I'm kidding. But I mean, tell me where do they go to college there?
They go to the University of Nairobi. They go to the technical school. It's a former British colony. It's a city. It's an actual city. I mean, it's not, you know, there's nobody fighting lions. There are Maasai. I did see a few Maasai guys in tribal outfits with spears, which was pretty badass.
We might have to have Josh back on because we got to wrap this up. Everything you've been talking about is so interesting to me. I hope the listeners like it too. This is the Joe Downtown Show, KUNV 91.5, The Source. With producer Steve Zeller. This has been Josh Ellis on the show. I'm Joe Shaneman, a writer for Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly. Thanks for listening.